In this part of the show, we will be talking about climate change in our part of the country, the Great Lakes region, and perhaps even more specific than that, about what we think is likely to happen over the next 100 years or so here in Illinois and also Indiana. Our guest for the program is Catherine Hayhoe. She's an atmospheric scientist. She's an independent research consultant who is particularly interested in how science and public policy come together. She has done work on the impact of human activities on climate, also on issues like greenhouse gas emissions and how they can be controlled. She has a master's degree in atmospheric science from the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, and has done work for a wide range of both government and private agencies in Canada and in the United States, including the EPA, the U.S. EPA, Environment Canada, the Ontario Ministry of Energy and the Environment, the Department of Energy, and we'll be talking about a report that she was involved in, a recent report looking at this issue of climate change in the Midwest. She was a number of contributors to this report, which was sponsored by the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Ecological Society of America, although the scientists who, people who worked on the report, don't work for those organizations. Those organizations sponsored the report, but they were all independents. Independent scientists who contributed to the report. She's here to be a part of a panel discussion that is being called Visualizing the Global, Computer Modeling, Ecology, and Politics. This is going to be taking place tonight at 6 at the Beckman Institute Auditorium. She is one of the panel members. And I think, you know, you might find it interesting, depending on what kind of discipline you're in. I think as we have been chatting before we got going, that the idea of this discussion is how can you take subjects that might, to the non-scientist, be difficult to understand, things that involve a lot of numbers, and make them present that information in a way that's more visually appealing and accessible to, as I say, particularly to people who aren't scientists. So that's kind of the idea. And this is open to, I know anybody who is interested in attending this should feel welcome to stop by. Again, that's in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute tonight at 6. Here on the program, of course, questions are welcome as always, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. If at any point here you have questions, you're welcome to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Overall, I guess the big thing that you know, that people want to know, the big concern, and then I guess there are things that follow from that, is the issue of temperatures and whether, you know, what's going on in terms of trends, what can we expect over the next 100 years or so. Now, what this report says, it says what now a series of reports and scientists have been saying for some time, is that they believe that the average annual temperature will go up.
That's
maybe
correct.
The big question, though, that from there is, well, how much? Mm-hmm. That's still uncertain.
Well, temperature is one of the first things we think of when we hear the words global warming. Mm-hmm. For a reason. And even though temperature is expected to increase anywhere from 5 to 12 degrees over the globe, it will change. It will really depend on the area. And for Illinois in specific, we found that temperature could increase 7 to 13 degrees Fahrenheit in winter by the end of the century and 9 to 18 degrees Fahrenheit by summer towards the end of the century. The reason why these numbers are higher than the global averages that you might see in a newspaper report, for example, is because Illinois and Indiana are here in the middle of a continent. And so we're closer to the North Pole. We're going to see greater warming at higher latitudes. And we're also right in the middle without the moderating influence of ocean or lakes around us.
Mm-hmm. That's a big spread. We're talking about that it could be anything from 5 to 12 degrees Fahrenheit in winter, and anything from 5 to 20 in summer. So it could be even more serious, you know, if it goes to the max, it'd be even more serious in the summertime. So we're looking at a lot hotter summers. But there's a big spread here. Is there any way to be more firm about which end of this spread we're likely to see?
Yes, there is a big range, and there's two causes for that range. The first cause is, first of all, the uncertainty in exactly how our environment will react to the gases that we're pumping into the atmosphere. And that uncertainty accounts for 40% of the range that we've given. But the greater part of that range, 60%, is due to uncertainty in how our behavior will change over the next century. So really, part of this range is up to us. Will we continue to use coal, gas, and oil the way we've been doing it over the last century? Or are we going to transition to more renewable sources?
Well, is there then the issue, would you say that it will get warmer? The question is just how much warmer? Or is there even a question about whether, in fact, it will get warmer at all?
That's a good point. I can say with certainty that it will get warmer, because what we've already been doing is we've already been releasing these heat-trapping gases now for well over a century. So to use a picture from this time of year, it's as if we've been raking leaves into a pile. We already have a good-sized pile of these leaves, and so that will already affect climate. The question is, do we make that into a huge pile of leaves, or do we try to keep it small?
Mm-hmm. Now, I know one of the things that people will point out is they will look at going back as far as we can make determinations about what's happened with the climate. There are waves. You know, there are times when average global temperature goes up, average global temperature goes down. And there's this idea that, you know, over time there are going to be these swings. I guess one of the questions that people want to know about this warming trend is this something that's just another swing? It's going to go up for a while, and then maybe after that it will go down for a while. Or is this something that is a longer-term change? And I sort of hesitate to use the word permanent, but that it's a longer-term change, and it's not something that we would expect within this normal pattern over a long period of time, this normal pattern of up and down.
That is a very good question, and there is no doubt that a lot of variations in climate are due to natural causes. The sun's output changes from decade to decade, and we've known that for a long time. There's also volcanic eruptions, which spew a lot of dust into the atmosphere and tend to cool the Earth. Natural variability has accounted for most of what we've seen over the past thousands of years. However, in this century, natural variability can account for most of what we saw for the first 50 years. But during the last 50 years of the century, we have seen an increase in temperature that cannot be accounted for by natural causes. We are fairly familiar with the natural variations due to solar output and due to other different factors. And the latest computer models have shown that unless you include the effect of heat-trapping gas emissions that we've been pumping out over the last century, there is no way that you can model the temperature increases that we've seen over the last decades.
Mm-hmm. So there the feeling is that it is the result of human activity, that it's something that we have actually done. Not that that was the intent, but it was the result of something that we had done, that it is about burning fossil fuels, and that there's no doubt, well, in your mind, there's no doubt that that's what it's all about.
What we have seen is definitely a combination of our greenhouse gas emissions with natural variability. Okay. And there's no way you can account for it if you do not include the effect of these greenhouse gases.
So here, in terms of what you're suggesting that we're going to expect over the next century or so, that there will, you believe that here in Illinois and Indiana, there's going to be an increase in the average temperature, and that we should expect warmer winters, even warmer summers on average, and that probably also that we should expect longer summers.
Yes.
As well.
We have already seen that winters have become shorter and shorter in this region. Annual average temperatures have increased over the last 50 years. The extent of lake ice has been decreasing to the point where in 2001 it was the winter of no ice. We almost missed a winter there with no lake ice. And so we've already seen a lot of signs. Another sign we've seen is that heavy rainfall events have almost doubled in frequency over the last 100 years.
Mm. Now, this is interesting because one of the things I definitely want to talk about, and certainly around in this part of the country where there are a lot of people who make their living in agriculture, precipitation, when the rain comes and how much it comes at one time, that's a big issue. Is it that we're expecting that there should be some change in the total average precipitation, or that we're saying, well, that's not exactly what we're talking about, but that we should expect that we're going to have more, when it does come, that we're more likely to have heavy downpours, and that there, so that, that there we're going to have more concerns about flooding, for example, you know, potential crop damage, difficulties working in the field, you know, all that come, that stuff that comes from getting your rain too much at one time.
Yes, that's what we're looking at here. According to the latest projections of what temperature and precipitation will look like over the next century, we're not expecting a big change in annual average precipitation, mm-hmm. but what we are expecting is a change in how that rainfall is distributed over the year. And we're looking at two major shifts. The first shift is that more will occur in winter and spring and less in summer and fall. And the second shift that we saw is that more will occur in heavy downpours and less in between.
So we should expect more snow, more blizzards, and then, though, when it comes around to the summertime, we should expect that the summers are likely overall to be drier, but we might also expect more heavy thunderstorms and big rain events within a short period of time.
Yes, that's very possible.
Well, we have a caller here. We'd welcome other people if you have questions you'd like to call in. We're talking this morning with Catherine Hayhoe. She is an atmospheric scientist. She is a contributor to a report that was issued recently on looking at climate change in the Great Lakes. She has done a lot of this kind of work and has worked for both government and private organizations in the United States, in Canada, and is here to take part in a conference that we talked about a little bit, panel discussion we talked a little bit about at the beginning of the program. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. We have a caller in Belgium by Danville on our line number four right here. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. In prehistoric times, there was a huge lake in this general area. And when that lake emptied into the Atlantic Ocean many, many years ago, long time ago, it dramatically changed the weather by introducing a lot of cold water into the North Atlantic as the water flowed out of the lakes. Now, recently, there was a large melt in northern Canada in what the Baffin Island or something like that area, where a large saltwater lake drained very, very quickly into the northern Arctic Ocean at that point. Now, the question I have, the first spill of water, fresh water, into the ocean changed the way that the Gulf Stream went and everything, and dramatically changed weather. I don't know if it brought on the Ice Age or stopped the Ice Age, but dramatically affected. Is there a possibility that this large drop of water, and this is very salty water, so it's going to sink to the bottom, flowing into the oceans, are going to change the weather also?
That's a very good point you bring up, the question of freshwater and saltwater balances and how that might change the ocean circulation. I'm not an oceanographer, but I do know that the ocean circulation is like a giant conveyor belt. It takes heat from one part of the world and redistributes it to others. And how that's going to be affected in the future is a major concern. In terms of what's happened recently, I can't really speak to the exact impact of that, although I do not believe it will be sufficient to change the thermohaline circulation of the ocean. But large-scale melting of the polar ice caps certainly could do that. And if the circulation of the ocean were to reverse or to shut down, as we know from records that it has in the prehistoric past, then we could be looking at very, very drastic results. And so, for example, the global warming and the temperature changes that we're looking at over the next century, they do not include the potential for catastrophe. This is if the world proceeds as normal. But we always have to remember that we are in a world that's carefully balanced, and we are upsetting that balance, and who knows what could happen if we could trigger something that is, you know, ends up completely out of our control.
Well, as long as the Arctic ice cap really doesn't affect the sea level because the ice is floating on top of the water. But the truly dangerous one is to lose a great deal of the polar cap on the Antarctic, which is sitting on ground. And that will raise the level of oceans quite a bit, which larger oceans are actually going to have a very large effect on the weather too, because water has a much more calming effect of of the environment. So we really have to worry more about the Antarctic than we do the Arctic. Is that right?
Yes, that's a very good point. But not only due to the rising sea levels, though, but also due to the injection of fresh water, as you brought up earlier. That can really affect the ocean circulation. So that is a good point. We do need to keep in mind the effect that we're having on the oceans. We can't take them for granted.
Well, thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is a point where I guess I'm a little confused because, as the caller suggests, some people who are concerned about the issue of global warming, one of the issues that they raise is an increase in a rise in sea level, which could be very significant when you think about those places around the world that are at sea level now. And that people are saying, even a relatively small rise in sea level could result, for example, in loss of significant coastal area of the United States. And then there are other places in the world that might simply find themselves underwater. And I guess here's where I'm a little bit confused. Well, the report suggests that the situation in the Great Lakes would actually be different. Here, they're projecting a decline in the water level in the Great Lakes. And I guess I don't understand why if the concern of the oceans is that the sea level would rise, why would the level in the Great Lakes drop?
To answer that question, we have to look at the reasons why sea level would rise and the reasons why lake levels would drop. Sea level is expected to rise for two reasons. One is the one that everybody thinks of, the ice caps melting. Mm. But the second, and perhaps even more important one over the next century, is thermal expansion. Warmer water just takes up more space. Okay. So those are the reasons why sea level will rise. But sea level does not affect the Great Lakes. Great Lakes, their lake levels are determined by a balance between the amount of rainfall they receive and the amount of water that evaporates out of them and the amount of groundwater that flows into them. So these are the factors that determine lake level. And in the future, we already know, we've seen, that winter ice cover has been decreasing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the evaporation actually happens in the winter. So when it freezes, it seals off the lake from evaporating. If there's less ice cover in the future, there's going to be a lot more evaporation happening in the winter. And there'll be more evaporation in the summer as well, because warmer air can actually hold more water vapor. So more water can evaporate in the summer. And if precipitation stays about the same, what's going to happen is the evaporation will cause the lake levels to drop.
All right. So that's the bottom line thing. It is, and if we're thinking that we're going to get the same amount of precipitation, that's not particularly an issue. But if it's warmer and you don't have your ice cover, then more evaporation. That's
right. Okay. And actually, we've seen a drop in some of the Great Lake levels over the past few years. Since 1997, there's actually been lower than average rainfall over the Great Lakes Basin, and there's been a lot of warm winters with not much ice cover. And so what's happened is, for example, in Lake Huron, lake levels have dropped up to 4 feet. Some people who have cottages and other summer homes there have actually lost their lakefront.
Really? Wow. Okay. Let's talk with someone else here, someone on the campus on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, this has been a very lucid discussion so far. I have two questions. One is, do you have any predictions about tornadoes?
That's a very good question. Currently, our model resolution is not high enough to actually look at such small-scale events, but that's something we're working on, and that's actually something that this seminar this evening we'll be talking about, because we're starting to work very closely with people at NCSA to develop the computer capabilities to look at small-scale features like that. I think over in Japan, they have a new Earth system computer there that has just been able to, in the last couple of weeks, actually resolve tornado-scale events. So it's a little early to say what's going to happen with those, but that is the next avenue of research that we'll be looking at.
Sounds like you wouldn't be surprised. And number two, the big the thing you touched on early when you talked about solar input versus or solar output versus man-made accumulation of greenhouse gases, that was a key thing as far as I understood the whole problem, and it sounds, can you refine what you said a little bit more? Like, for example, can you say which percentage out of the last 50 years, what percentage of the increase in average temperatures is due to solar output increasing versus greenhouse gases? And number two, kind of related to that, is are you saying, therefore, that there are models out there that track both the solar output and the greenhouse gas increases, and that they track them quite well? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. That was a great question. Yes, climate models today certainly take account of changes in solar forcing, because that is very important. They also include changes in greenhouse gases, which trap heat, also aerosols, which are little particles that actually usually tend to cool the atmosphere. They also include stratospheric ozone depletion, the ozone hole, because that affects temperatures on Earth as well. And so what we see over the last century is that if you only look at natural variations, which includes solar, as well as the other natural variations in the Earth's climate, by the end of this century, you would not see much of a net change in temperature. In fact, over the last few decades, due to solar forcing, temperature should actually be cooling a little bit. But instead, we have seen the opposite. We have seen temperature rise almost 1 degree Celsius over the last 3 decades. And the only explanation for that, if you include all of the natural variations, including solar, is that these heat-trapping greenhouse gases must be responsible for the rise that we've seen, because solar simply does not account for it. In fact, it should have gone down a little bit.
I'm just curious about the caller asked the question about tornadoes. One of the things that people have asked is about whether we are expecting trends in the amount of severe weather that we might be experiencing. We've already talked about the fact that it's predicted that while the average precipitation, we're not expecting that to change very much, we might see a change in the patterns so that we would expect to get more at one time. Tornadoes are produced by severe thunderstorms. It does seem reasonable to think that we might indeed have more tornadoes. Is that a reasonable kind of assumption to make?
I think that is a reasonable assumption, that the more extreme the weather gets, the more extreme events you'll probably see. Mm-hmm. Right now, like I said, we're not able to look at the actual scale that tornadoes happen on, but we have looked at other extreme events. For example, heat waves. There was a big heat wave in 1996 in Chicago that was responsible for almost 700 deaths. Mm-hmm. And the frequency of heat waves will certainly increase in the future. But similarly, the frequency of cold waves will decrease. And then again, the frequency of heavy rainfall events has been seen to increase over the last 100 years and is likely to double again by the end of the century.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Catherine Hayhoe. She's an independent research consultant. She's particularly interested in how science and public policy come together, and is interested in the impact of human activities on climate, on greenhouse gas emissions, and also what we do to try to control that. She has done work for the governments of both Canada and the United States, for Environment Canada and for the EPA. She's also worked for the Ontario Ministry of Energy and the Environment, the Department of Energy. I assume that's the U.S. Department of Energy.
That's right.
And she's a graduate of University of Illinois. She has her master's degree in atmospheric sciences here from the U of I Urbana-Champaign. And she was one of the researchers that was involved and contributed to a report looking at climate change in the Great Lakes that was jointly sponsored by the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Ecological Society of America. And I'm sure that if people are interested in looking at the report or a summary of the report, and they have internet access, they can get at it by going to the Union of Concerned Scientists, to their website, mm-hmm. and they can see it there.
That's right. You can reach it directly at www.ucsusa.org/Great Lakes, all one word.
And on this program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What implications are there to this to the decrease in the level of the lakes, of the Great Lakes?
Water issues are already a concern in this region. There's a lot of demands for the water that we have here, demands for consumption, for industrial use, for agriculture. Currently, we're actually withdrawing from our aquifers at an unsustainable rate. Our underground aquifers are not recharging as quickly as we're actually withdrawing water from them. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the city of Chicago withdrawing from Lake Michigan, that's always a concern because, of course, the lake touches many other states and withdrawals are currently regulated. So lake level drops could really affect water availability and water quality in the region, and that is a major concern. And even though it's a concern, let me say, first of all, too, that it's something that we can plan for and that we need to plan for. The reason why we did this analysis is to provide people with the information that they can use to make decisions in the future, water management plans, conservation, other things like that.
Mm-hmm. That's well, certainly I know that there are people who in this part of the state that are concerned about this, and in fact who are saying this is something we really ought to be talking about because in certain places we're having certain places are growing. There's increasing demand for water. Here we depend on one aquifer in particular, and that it's a one that is going to be recharged by rainfall. I mean, eventually, you know, the rain falls on the ground. Eventually, it percolates down into there and gets into the where the aquifer is. Mm-hmm. Now, but you know, as we've said a couple of times, we're not expecting a big change in the average annual precipitation. So why should, and if we're not going to have less rain and snow overall, why should we be concerned about the aquifer's ability to recharge itself? I mean, does the issue that it's going to come in bigger, maybe in bigger amounts, does that actually make a difference?
That could be because during heavy rainfall, more of it runs off and less of it is absorbed by the soil because it's already saturated. But I think one of the reasons that we need to plan for the future here is because our population is increasing. We are needing more and more water every day. We're not remaining stable. And so even if our water resources did not change in the future, we would still have problems with availability because we are increasing.
I know that you, before we got going, you said that you didn't particularly feel that you were an expert on agriculture, but can we, I guess I want to talk a little bit more about the impact on agriculture. We've mentioned one thing where we talked about the fact that either, even though we're not expecting that the average precipitation is going to change, that we might expect that we're going to have more heavy rainfalls. There's going to be more rain in a shorter period of time. So that's potentially a problem. Also, timing of the rainfall is an issue too, because in farming you want to, you know, not only you got to have it, but you got to have it at the right time. Mm-hmm. There are also, I guess, some maybe on the plus side, we are expecting a longer growing season because we're expecting the summer is going to be longer, and winters have been getting shorter, summers have been getting longer. What can you say about, or what does anybody think about in terms of pluses or minuses and the impact on agriculture of the warming that is expected?
Well, agriculture is already under a lot of pressure, particularly the smaller farms. And mm-hmm. what we found is that increased variability in climate will primarily impact the smaller farms that are less able to absorb changes from year to year. First of all, increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will actually boost yields for some crops. And as you pointed out, there will be longer growing seasons and longer frost-free periods, so people could even go to double cropping sometimes, and there are some benefits, and that's important to note. But however, there are also drawbacks. And those include the increased frequency of heavy rainfall events, shifts in rainfall from summer and fall moving back and towards spring and winter, more water when you don't necessarily want it and less when you do. Mm-hmm. Also, higher ozone concentrations can counter the positive impacts of a warmer climate by stunting plant growth. And the warmer winters might actually be a detriment to agriculture because what we've actually seen happening is that pests are moving northward. We're seeing pests here that we have not seen in previous years, and their range is expanding northward as temperatures warm.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller here. We have someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Mr. Hinch, you've introduced your guest as someone concerned with public policy as well as with the science. What we've heard about thus far is primarily the scientific predictions. I'm calling with a plea to change the subject. Could we hear some about the public policy? and I'd like to hang up and listen.
All right. Well, fine and appropriate question. Let's do that.
Thank you.
I guess that, so obviously we've talked about what we think is likely to happen. The question is, on a lot of people's mind is, okay, what do you do about this?
Right. Well, as we discussed earlier, there's a big range in the temperature changes that we could see in the future, and 60% of that range depends on the choices that we make. And there are choices that we can make at every level. Often people feel helpless. I'm just an individual. What can I do? It's up to the government. The government's not doing anything. And you feel like there's nothing that can be done. But in fact, there's a lot of good news already out there, and there's a lot of things that can be done at every level. Obviously, at the national level, they could implement plans such as renewable energy portfolios, vehicle emission controls, plans to reduce emissions of these heat-trapping gases, and also plans to accelerate technology development so that we don't need to use as much energy and we can still have the same lifestyle and the same benefits. At the state level, there's a lot of state-level regulations that can be put in place, and states often govern the type of energy and the different emissions that controls that are allowed. I think Chicago itself, they have committed themselves to local emission reductions through what's called the International Cities for Climate Protection campaign. Over 200 cities around the world have signed on to this plan. I myself am a native of Toronto, and Toronto has actually reduced their greenhouse gas emissions by 50% in just a decade.
How was that done?
The way that they did it is they looked at their fleet of vehicles, and they increased efficiency in vehicle fleets. They turned out the lights and turned off the computers when they were done for the day. And they also trapped the gases that came out of the landfills. Because methane, for example, which we haven't talked much about today, but methane is the second most important greenhouse gas from human activities, and it's released when organic material decays. Mm-hmm. And so wastewater treatment plants, sewage, and landfills are a major source of methane. Per molecule, methane actually traps 24 times more heat than a molecule of carbon dioxide. So when you take care of a little bit of methane, it's the same as if you're taking care of a lot of carbon dioxide.
Yeah, and methane actually is a potentially usable commodity. Is that, in addition to trapping it so that it doesn't get released in the atmosphere, was that turned into an energy source?
Yes, you can burn it for fuel. That's right. So these are examples you can do at the federal, national, and city level. Also on the city level, sustainable planning. Planning a city so that there's bike paths, there's public transportation. People don't need to commute an hour or two to work. They don't need to drive their car. That's a great way to reduce energy. Building codes. Illinois, I believe, does not actually have a statewide energy efficiency building code. And putting that in would encourage people to actually start building responsibly and save money in the long run. And then, of course, on the individual level, there's a lot that we can do. For example, in our house, we recently replaced our furnace. We had a very old furnace. It was probably about 65% efficient. We replaced it with a 97% efficient furnace, and we're going to pay off that furnace in 3 to 5 years, just with the gas savings that we have. And then, of course, everybody's heard about changing your light bulbs. It's very simple, but these light bulbs last a lot longer, and they use 10% of the electricity of a normal light bulb if you use a halogen or compact bulb.
So the bottom line is here for the caller and for everybody else is that on the individual level, there are things that people can do. And basically what we're talking about is greater energy efficiency. Using in any way that you possibly can, use less energy, particularly when we're talking about energy that's the result of burning fossil fuel. So either we're talking about the internal combustion engine, or even, you know, when you flip on the light switch in your house, that most likely that energy was produced by burning fossil fuel. So the less energy that you use, the more you turn out the lights when you don't need them, the more in your home appliances you get the most energy efficient that you can. So your refrigerator and your furnace and your air conditioner, you know, whatever you have that uses the smallest amount of energy, those things are constructive things that people can do.
That's right. Here in Illinois, a lot of our electricity comes from coal, and the same is also true in Indiana. So when you flip on that light switch, you're actually in effect burning coal. But on a statewide level, wind energy. Illinois has the potential to supply 80% of its electricity from wind energy. So we're the coal capital of the world now. We could become the wind energy capital of the world very easily. And then you could just switch on your light and all that's happening is the windmill's turning.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left here. We have another caller, and the next person up is in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello, I am listening. I did come in late in the conversation, but I have a very acute interest in the issue of climate control and things like the Kyoto Protocol and international agreements, as well as local and state and federal regulations. My question to you, and I think it's a follow-up to the public policy concerns of the previous caller, my concern is, are you being a little bit Pollyannish in this? Because I've heard very little about the political and economic cost or impulses associated with some of the solutions you propose, whether it's in terms of climate control or water conservation methods. When you have the President of the United States say economic growth trumps all other concerns, and I got a feeling that may percolate to the state and local levels, especially a state like Illinois, who doesn't have a strong environmental ethic. Are you being a little naive when you don't take into account the countervailing political and economic cost of what you suggest on this, have been suggesting on this program?
To be perfectly honest, I think those who believe that economic growth can only occur at the cost of environmental progress are the ones who are being naive. The people who have actually gone ahead and implemented different strategies, for example, three Great Lakes states, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, have implemented renewable electricity standards, and they have actually enjoyed significant economic and environmental benefits at the same time. Often, I think there's actually too much of a negative connotation where you have to choose either the environment or the economy. But America is built on the concept of entrepreneurship. When we're given a problem or an issue, the ideas start flowing. And so I think to give the American people, to give the engineers, the people who are experts in technology, give them the incentive to do something about it. And they can rise to the challenge, and I think that we might actually end up surprising ourselves with what we could achieve in terms of both economic growth and environmental benefits.
Well, I'm not denying that. I think in a world of in a utopian world, I agree with you. I do believe in sustainable development, which I think you are basically describing. But I'm saying in the reality of the situation, America's penchant for consumption rather than conservation, how we are addicted to fossil fuels, especially Mideastern oil and Venezuelan oil, how our politicians pander to these vices, and how industry can overestimate the cost and underestimate the technology available to deal with pollution control. As a political and economic reality, what real hopes do we have of implementing what you suggested?
That is a good point. And at the federal level, I agree that the picture you've painted is fairly true. Industry consistently overestimates how much it will cost and underestimates the technology available. An example is requests for increases in fuel standards, calls to roll back the Clean Air Act that's been in place for over two decades. But the good news, though, and one that you don't hear so often, is that at the state and city level, there's a lot of activity happening. Certain states, like the ones I cited, for example, that you might be surprised that Michigan would be one of the ones looking at a renewable energy portfolio, and of course California, there's a lot going on there, but actually all across the country, including Texas, the president's home state, they are taking initiative on their own. They're seeing that the leadership is not coming down from the federal level, but they see that there is motivation to clean up both greenhouse gas emissions and local pollutants, to look at renewable energy sources, to build sustainable cities. And this is happening, believe it or not, at the state and at the city level. And that's really encouraging news.
I hope you're right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. Again, we have about maybe 7 or 8 minutes left with Catherine Hayhoe here on the program. If you have questions, comments, you're certainly welcome to call. She was one of the contributors to a report looking at the issue of climate change in the Great Lakes region that was sponsored by, commissioned by the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Ecological Society of America. So if you have questions, you can give us a call. I guess the caller puts his finger on the issue, on the right question, and that is, we can talk about change all day long, but if people don't get behind it, then it's really not going to happen. And it does seem that, it, as you say, on the federal level, people are not quite as progressive as maybe they are on other levels. Is this something, though, do you think that people actually, that a substantial number of people care about and are interested in and, in fact, are trying on their own level, on the individual level, actually, to do whatever they can to make a contribution in this area, that is, to greater energy efficiency, less pollution?
That's a good question, and actually that would be a good question for our listeners if they have anything to say about their personal actions or people they know. I know for myself, it really varies by location, and it varies by how much people are aware of this issue. And so what we were trying to do with this report and also with this workshop later on tonight is make people aware of what is going on around the world. Because why would you take action if you don't know what's going on? And so once people are aware not only of the problem, but that there are common sense solutions that we can take up right now, you don't have to feel paralyzed that this is a global problem. There's no way that you can address it. Once you're aware that there's very, very small steps that each individual person can take, then I think people feel like they can take action on this.
Do you think that you mentioned a little earlier that you were living in Toronto? Do you think that the government of Canada, as a government, is doing better dealing with these issues than the government of the United States?
The government of Canada has agreed to the Kyoto Protocol, which one of our previous callers mentioned. The Kyoto Protocol is an international agreement for countries to reduce their emissions of these heat-trapping gases by 2012. And that is definitely a step forward. What's happening as a result of that is that the reductions they achieve under Kyoto are not so much the most important thing. The important thing is that this agreement is starting people to think about the issue and to develop the technologies that we need to move into the next century. So, for example, in Canada, the government has supplied several $1 million grants to different corporations to develop new technologies. But then there's also a lot of action happening at the individual level. In the city of Toronto, the average consumer got together and they put up a wind turbine generator in downtown Toronto that was entirely supported by private money. Each person got a share of that generator. It cost $1 million Canadian, which is about 700,000 U.S., and their electricity is going back on the grid, but they are each getting a share of that wind generator. And so there's really some very, very interesting things going on north of the border that the states could actually look to and reap the benefits of.
Hmm. Well, again, we have a couple of minutes left here. Somebody real quick wants to get on the phone and ask a question. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, one of the reasons that you're here is to take part of this panel discussion that's going to be going on tonight, visualizing the global computer modeling ecology and politics. And as we have discussed, I guess that the idea here is to find ways to take a scientific and technical subject and present it in a way that's accessible to people who are not scientists. And that's probably always been a challenge for people who are scientists, who are in technological fields, to be able to talk about what they do and their issues and their concerns with people who are not scientists. And I suppose, again, there's an issue that's connected with that, and that is anytime we talk about technology and changes in technology, I think we say, well, it would be a great thing if we're talking about something that has potential wide impact, that we ought to have a discussion. You know, there ought to be debate and discussion, and everybody ought to be involved. And the fact is that often that does not happen. Do you think that there is a way that more people, that there could be a kind of a discussion of technology, what we're doing and what directions we're going in? Is it really possible to get that to be a kind of a conversation that more people participate in, so that people actually maybe will have some, at least some possibility to have a voice in policy making before the policy is made?
Well, that would be ideal, because we are all stakeholders. We all have something to gain and something to lose in this issue. And so it would be great to have everybody's voice heard. The first thing to do is to be informed on what the issues are. And so I would encourage people to attend the workshop tonight. And then also tomorrow, I believe, also at 6 p.m., they are actually going to provide a public demonstration of the visualization capabilities that they have there at NCSA. And this is a really amazing opportunity to see some of the technologies they have there. So I would encourage people to come along tonight to hear the presentations, but then also come by tomorrow to see the visualizations that they've prepared. These are state-of-the-art visualizations that have been used in all kinds of, not just scientific, but also public applications. I believe NCSA visualizations were actually used in that movie Twister that they made a few years ago to look at the tornadoes.
Yeah, I kind of think that's right.
Yeah.
And I think with that thing, though, it's one of these things that's kind of like a limited number of people can participate. So I think what they want to do, you got to kind of sign up for it if you really want to make sure that you can do this, because they can only take so many people. So that's one thing that they're asking.
Sign up tonight.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and again, it's the thing that we've been talking about here. It's titled Visualizing the Global, and it's part of a campus initiative, Silicon, Carbon, and Culture, different kinds of events going on all through the year. And that's tonight at 6, from 6 to 8:30, this panel discussion, and our guest, Catherine Hayhoe, will be one of the participants. That's tonight at 6 o'clock in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute on the campus at North Matthews. And if you're interested in looking at this report on climate change in the Midwest that we have talked about, this one that was jointly sponsored by Union of Concerned Scientists and the Ecological Society of America, you can go to the website of the Union of Concerned Scientists. So that's
www.ucsusa.org.
Okay. So Union of Concerned Scientists, United States, .org.
Yes.
And take a look at it there. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. Our guest, Catherine Hayhoe.